You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the CyberWire's Research Saturday. I'm Dave Bittner, and this is our weekly conversation with researchers and analysts tracking down threats and vulnerabilities, solving some of the hard problems of protecting ourselves in a rapidly evolving cyberspace. Thanks for joining us.
Well, APT41 is a longstanding group that's been around since, according to the recent indictment, 2011. We at Symantec have actually been tracking them since 2012. So shortly after they popped up, they got on our radar.
That's John DiMaggio from Symantec's Threat Hunter team. The research we're discussing today is titled APT41, Indictments Put Chinese Espionage Group in the Spotlight. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
I guess what their biggest claim to fame or what they were known for is they're one of the early adapters that really got into leveraging attacks for what they call supply chain attacks, leveraging victims for attacks for a later stage of a bigger objective. So they would get into all these other companies in order to use them to sort of traverse by those trusted relationships into what their actual target was. And, you know, they were one of the groups that sort of created that and started doing that. You know, we really didn't see much of that, and now it's much more common, but these guys were doing it, you know, starting back in 2012. But it's also one of the most confusing groups because, you know, most of the attackers that you see, while in the espionage game especially, if they're a group that is involved in espionage, you generally don't see cybercrime. So that really confused a lot of researchers. And so the reason I'm sort of throwing that in is, you know, when we look and we track activity and you try to identify motivation, it really throws you off when you start to see very different types of attacks where you're looking for a complete different end result. You don't usually see financial gain involved with an operation that is trying to steal information that's clearly going to be used for political or military purposes. So this group really is interesting because of that. So you have all these pockets of activity. You'd see things, you know, involving clearly very custom developed, sophisticated espionage malware that steals information, and then you see other attacks where they're leveraging that and using it for financial gain. And really, you know, one of the biggest differences, you know, in that was looking in what the times of use of when these types of attacks were doing. But we can talk about that a little bit more, but in detail. But yeah, we've been tracking them since 2011, and they have quite a tool set of their own malware that they use for for these attacks. We assessed that they were, a small group. They clearly had ties back to the China region, and they clearly had the resources to have, custom tools, custom malware, and they appeared to be very long-term, objective-oriented attackers, meaning they'd have all these different phases of an attack before you could figure out what the actual real, true objective was.
Can you give us some insights as a researcher? What is the process like for you and your colleagues for sort of connecting the dots, for determining as time goes by, what do you include with this group? What do you exclude? How do you make that circle smaller and smaller over time to know exactly who you're dealing with and likely what they're up to?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So the normal process of how we apply that against any sort of targeted attack is to not just look at the first attack. So usually you begin because of one event or one attack. But what you need to do when it comes to these sophisticated attackers is expand that pivot and identify other infrastructure, other malware, other victims, and then do a rear view mirror look to see, okay, are there other campaigns? Maybe there's a different vertical, a different sector that's been targeting that you're not seeing, but you can learn about the tactics from that group. So you really need to pivot and look back, rearview mirror, collect all that information, reanalyze everything that you have, and sort of come up with a bigger picture hypothesis of what that attacker is doing, what is their motivation, and what is, all these smaller attacks lead up to. This group, however, made that very difficult. And the reason I say that is what I alluded to before. We looked at the pocket of activity. And when you have custom malware that you believe is unique to an attacker, especially something that you think is resourced back to a nation, that attacker is for those military government purposes. Therefore, you don't usually see that very sophisticated malware used for financial gain attacks. And the reason why is, they spend all this time developing this malware. You don't want to take the chance that it's going to get identified and then researchers and antivirus and defenders can now write signatures to detect it. And your advanced operation that you spent all this time and money on is a major component of it is no longer usable. So that's what was so weird about this is, we were seeing what was clearly espionage operations. And then shortly after, we began to see these financial gain motivated attacks. One of the things that we did, I sort of alluded to earlier, that really helped us to figure this out was time boxing the activity. So taking longer range time periods of the activity and plotting the hours of actual, human on victim network time. So when a human was actually logged in doing things as part of the attack. So those high fidelity timestamps, if you will, of events. And then you plot those over time and you sort of look for what would fit in a workday. This is really relevant for nation state attacks because usually your A-game guys are working a day shift. That's just the trend that we often see. You have different teams. Usually your A-game guys will be working during the day. So anyway, you look for that to try to come up with time zones that fit a possible workday, and then you apply that to regions of the world. Well, what we noticed when we did that is there were very distinctive patterns between, while using the same malware and tools, there were very distinctive patterns between the espionage geared attacks versus the cybercrime financial gain motivated attacks. And what we saw was those the financial gain motivated attacks against many of the video game companies that we saw were actually taking place between 10 p.m. and 1 a.m. In the same time zone that we had leveraged from the time zone analysis of the espionage attacks. So by applying that, because we had less data for the cybercrime, so applying though that same time zone to those attacks, assuming that because the malware is so unique that the people using it must be at least have a relationship with those who are doing the espionage attack, allow allowed us to sort of make that assumption. Okay, well, these guys are using it at night. And what's the first thing you think of as I say this? Moonlighting.
So yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah, exactly. Which makes it so interesting. You know, that's why. Yeah. So when do you ever see like espionage operators that, you know what, I got a few hours here tonight. Let's go make some money, guys. I mean, you just don't see that. And that we saw that back then, and that made this so interesting. And, you know, we did some collaboration with some of the analysts at FireEye. We talked about this at RSA this year, myself and some FireEye guys. We did a panel. We actually did a use case on this exact group. And the reason we did it is we at Symantec tracked them as two different groups. We believe that just like FireEye, they're the same individuals behind the activity. However, the actual buckets of activity, what they're doing was different. So we track it by the activity, not the people. FireEye tracks it more by the people, not the activity. So neither is wrong, but we track them very different. So that's one of the things that we discussed. Point being, though, that's what makes this so interesting is you have these, you know, operators moonlighting, using the same weapons, essentially to come up with different outcomes for different types of attacks.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me as kind of like, you know, hey, boss, you mind if I run off, you know, can I use the photocopier after hours or something? You know, that sort of thing. I can't imagine that these guys would be doing this without permission.
Well, so, yeah, exactly. I don't believe for a second that, I agree with you, you wouldn't expect them to, but I don't believe for a second that I'll just refer to it as their handlers, since, you know, we know from the indictment that there was relationships with some of the operators with the Ministry of Security and the National Security Bureau in Chengdu, that was in the indictment. So we don't know that that's who's behind the espionage attacks, but we know that some of the operators had working relationships with those organizations. But let's just call it the handlers behind the attacks, the ones paying for planning, that are benefiting from the attacks, whoever that is. I cannot imagine that they would be okay, though, with these guys using their military grade weapons, if you will, in their, you know, the secret sauce with their custom malware to steal, you know, something basically as dumb as video game currency. You know, that just seems like such a waste of your resources. Because, like I said, the more you expose your malware to the internet, to the world, the higher likelihood it's going to be identified, signatures written, and now it is no longer effective. So I just don't believe that they were on board or okay with that. I truly think that they probably did this on their own to make a buck and didn't think they would get caught. And then the fact that they worked with these guys in Malaysia and they created, you know, what I'll just call a shell company, the SEA Gamer Mall, that they essentially created that entity simply to sell the virtual currency that they had, you know, obtained in their theft campaign. So, you know, the whole thing is, these are all smart guys, clearly, but, you know, I think it's a bad day for them. Whether the indictments can touch them or not, I think it's a bad day for them in China when that indictment came out, because I really don't think that, like I said, if any government entity would be okay with you using that for your own financial purposes. And it's not like China is some poor nation that's going to benefit from financial theft attacks. You know, we see that sometimes with, you know, North Korea is the best example. We don't really see that with China, so it really doesn't fit their model.
Do we have any insights as to what the culture is among the elite hackers in China? And I come at the question from this direction, which is that, you know, I have heard here in the United States, you know, I've heard about you know, people with high technical abilities being referred to as, you know, rock stars or national treasures or, you know, those sorts of things. And so those people are well taken care of, you know, to the point of sometimes, you know, being coddled, or they may have peculiarities in their personality that are overlooked because their technical skills are so high. Do we have any insights into that, what may go on culturally in China?
Yeah, so I do actually have an opinion based off of, you know, experience from all the research and observing these groups for a number of years. So previously, like up to say maybe 2010, so from 2002 through like 2010, one of the really useful pieces of research that we could do was if you had any sort of a handle or any sort of unique piece of identifiable information in malware that you could use to find the developer. One of the things that used to take place was guys would leave a handle in malware. So there was a malware guy based out of China who used the alias YYT Hacker, who was just notorious for putting his handle within his malware. And, you know, that malware was eventually seen in some of these groups that we track, in espionage attacks. And so the things like that allowed you to go search and identify, all right, well, this guy is, you know, has this handle and he did a paper for a technical university in China with an email address with that same handle. You know, you could piece these things together. They got, and bear with me here and answer your question, but they have become much better at their operational security. It is rare now that you get things like that you can use to pivot on. And the reason that that's important is because I think the government really cracked down on that and said, hey, operators, you need to have discipline, or hackers, whatever word you want to use. You need to have discipline here. We're paying you. This is, you know, you're giving away our operations. You're giving away to identify us and attribute us. You need to stop doing that. The reason I believe that they took a stance to do that is because it tailored off so quickly, and it's so rare now that we get that sort of open source piece that we can really go dig and find the guys behind the keyboards. We have to rely so much more on either mistakes in operations or things in the malware or other things that are human-based patterns of what they do when they're on their network. They've made it much more difficult. But I don't think, though, that it's something that's condoned. I do think they do treat their operators, like you said, that rock star mentality. Absolutely. The guys that I think that are good at what they do, they're probably, you know, they are probably well-paid and treated decently in their home country. But there's the one thing that I think is important to always remember, you know, human greed, especially when it comes to money, it's something that can get the best of anyone. And I think that's really what you saw here.
Interesting. Well, let's dig into the indictments. Mid-September, the U.S. Department of Justice comes out and charges seven people, including some folks with APT 41, with a variety of crimes here. How did this impact you? What was your reaction to this?
A reaction is whenever we have an indictment come out, it's exciting because the indictments provide so much information and intelligence, not just on the attacks, but the people behind it. So we literally, when they come out, my team and I, we all sit down and read the entire, not just the blog that talks about the high level stuff. We should get down and we read into the weeds, because it's so interesting to take that and then compare it to our research and see what did we get right and what did we get wrong. A lot of times the things that you couldn't possibly know as a defender, only, you know, government type intelligence agencies could figure out. So these indictments really shed light on that. Doing that process with APT 41, I'll be honest, we got this one pretty, it was pretty good. Obviously we didn't have operator names, but as far as the way we tracked it, the way we broke up the malware, the operations, the way we separated them at Symantec, we actually had this pretty good. What I did find extremely interesting, though, was that human aspect. So, the fact that, as you mentioned, there are seven individuals. Well, there's only two of them that they specifically called out that, you know, worked both the espionage and the cybercrime operations. Now, obviously, we can infer that all of them had relationships in some way with one another, but the actual indictment itself only actually calls out two that did cybercrime and espionage, which to me says, you know, the others might have been involved in cross operations, but these are the two that we have black and white evidence to support that claim, since it's in the indictment itself. So I think that's really interesting. I think that the it wasn't really finger pointing, but it, you know, subtly was at some of the government agencies that they mentioned in the indictment that had relationships with the operators. I thought that was very interesting. Again, that's something that unless there is a mishap in their operations where they make a mistake and we get to see an IP, let's say forget to turn on a proxy and they originate from one of those entities. Unless things like that happen, we don't usually get the government piece behind behind it. So that was really interesting. The Chengdu 4-4 network technology piece, we've heard of that organization before. Didn't have evidence that it was necessarily bad, but there was a lot of suspicious things that were around that, so that was at least on our radar. And then the SEA Gamer Mall that was selling this fraudulent stuff, we had not heard of that before at all, but that was based out of Malaysia. That wasn't exactly our prime area of research in this, but adding all it had been together, like I said, I just sort of named the interesting pieces that we may not have necessarily ever known about, but putting it all together, you know, it really tells us, we're doing a good job in the way that we're tracking and doing our analysis. It isn't always like this where we get it, you know, all these things line up, but it's usually pretty good. But this one, we had a real win out of.
Now, do you suspect that the folks behind APT41 will change some of their tactics as a result of this indictment?
I do believe that. So the reason I think that that's definitely going to happen is we've seen it in the past. You know, I mean, the most high level example is, you know, APT1. You know, when that happened, they burned infrastructure, they shut down operations for several months, they rebuilt. That was a China-based group as well. But it's not just even China. You see that you can use Russia for another example. Let's talk about them. Completely different nation. But, you know, when like Dragonfly, the U.S. Energy infrastructure attacks that took place, you know, when that was one where we wrote a blog on that and we put information on that, and they shut down operations temporarily. They burned infrastructure. They retooled and they came back with a different style of attack. So I think despite the nation, I think that is generally what happens with espionage attackers. You know, lesser attackers don't necessarily have the resources to, you know, to stop, retool, recreate new malware, come up with new creative ideas to attack and start again once they've been identified. But governments certainly do. So I think that trend will continue here. But I don't think they'll go away. I think they'll slow down and we'll see a gap in activity, and then they'll come back with some new creative way to attack and to continue their operations with the same end results.
Our thanks to John DiMaggio from Symantec's Threat Hunter team. The research is titled APT41, Indictments Put Chinese Espionage Group in the Spotlight. We'll have a link in the show notes. The CyberWire Research Saturday is proudly produced in Maryland out of the startup studios of Data Tribe, where they're co-building the next generation of cybersecurity teams and technologies. Our amazing CyberWire team is Elliot Peltzman, Peru Prakash, Stefan Vaziri, Kelsey Bond, Tim Nodar, Joe Kerrigan, Carol Terrio, Ben Yellen, Nick Vilecki, Gina Johnson, Bennett Moe, Chris Russell, John Petrick, Jennifer Iben, Rick Howard, Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening.